Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Fergus Bordwick, who's the author of, amongst many other books about our government, The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. And they were extraordinary. Fergus was born in New York City, grew up in Yonkers. While growing up, he often traveled to Indian reservations around the U.S. with his mom, who was the executive director of the Association on American Indian Affairs, which was then the only independent advocacy organization for Native Americans, which in no doubt shaped his later life. He holds degrees from the City College of New York and Columbia. And back when, in the 60s, he did voter registration for the NAACP in the still-segregated South. He's also worked as a roustabout in Alaska's Arctic oil fields. He's been a taxi driver and a deckhand on a Norwegian freighter. So he's lived a very rich and varied life. And I could go on and on because the biography, which I suggest that you read on his website, really is fascinating. So welcome, Fergus. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam. It's great to be here.
Well, why don't you, obviously, because you can do it better than me, tell us a little bit about the book and how you came about deciding that you wanted to tell us about the Constitution and why you thought it was necessary to do so.
Well, the first federal Congress, that's the first Congress that met after the ratification of the Constitution, and it was it met in order to put the Constitution into practice, in other words, to create the government, to create this machine of government. That Congress has most often been thought of as something like an asterisk after the Constitutional Convention, when in fact it was one of the most prodigiously productive in American history. It was innovative. It did creative politics. It didn't do politics without stress and strain. It was as challenging and confrontational in 1789 as it is today. But it had an enormous and lasting impact on our country. And frankly, when it met, nobody knew whether it was going to succeed or whether the country was going to survive. In fact, nobody even knew if enough people were going to show up in New York, then the capital. Nobody knew if enough members were going to show up to actually perform their duties. John Adams, who was the vice president and presided over the Senate, worried that he thought half the members who did come probably couldn't go home before the end of Congress. So the fact that they succeeded is an amazing story. And I stumbled over this, so to speak, when I was writing a book some years ago about the creation of Washington, D.C., the national capital, which was one of the many things that was achieved by the first Congress, and realized that was just one of a whole host of significant pieces of legislation that were enacted by the first Congress.
Well, I guess I misspoke. I should have said the implementation of this this document, because the document was already there. But tell a little bit about how, you know, I guess it was in March when these guys started to get there, but how long it took before they actually had a quorum sufficient to work with the document.
Yeah, it took about a month to achieve a quorum in either the Senate or the House. Of course, remember, we're in 1789, and travel and transportation in the United States is pretty primitive. Indeed, there are members who are shipwrecked. More than one was shipwrecked. One had to wade ashore on Staten Island in New York when his ship ran aground. Others were land wrecked, as they said at the time. That's to say, their stagecoaches turned over, got bogged down in the mud. One member arrived at the second session with a patch over his eye and a concussion, and so on. So it wasn't so easy to get there in any case. But there was a lot of ambivalence about whether it was really worth the trouble. Now, the first Congress was dominated by Federalists, that's to say, those who believed in a strong, vigorous, creative central government. But there was an outspoken, even strident minority of anti-federalists who disliked the Constitution. They thought it was a terrible mistake, and they were eager to try to, if not undermine, at least change, transform the new constitutional government into something that accommodated a lot more power for the states and less power for the central government.
It's interesting when you're talking about getting here, getting there. Well, here I am in Philadelphia. But the idea of, for example, Thomas Jefferson enjoying himself in France, collecting art, wine, his library with Miss Hemings, it's almost like I can't imagine him saying, you know, okay, I'll come over. It's like it just seemed like he was so comfortable, as I might have been, that I would say, you know, I'm enjoying the ambassadorship. Maybe I'll just hang out here, you know?
Well, you put your finger on something there. Jefferson didn't want to come back, and he wanted to return to France once he had. And he put off and put off and put off accepting his appointment as Secretary of State. And, you know, if he could have traveled backwards from Virginia to New York, that's how he would have done it. He was not happy about it. Yes, he missed Paris, and he never returned to it. But he lived as close to a Parisian life as he could manage in New York with his wines and his books. I saw the invoice for the carpenter who built him a special library, a book room, so to speak, off his rented house on Maiden Lane in New York City, and he brought the Hemingses back with him. Indeed, Sally Hemings's brother was his steward or butler, perhaps you'd say, in that house in New York, and Sally was reestablished down at Monticello.
How much did his library cost? Do you remember the invoice?
Yeah, I just don't remember. It was pretty pricey for the time, but that Jefferson, as we all know, was a great Renaissance man, and he never hesitated to spend money on books. Then again, he was in debt his entire life, and his estate was deeply in debt when he died.
It's so funny when you think of all the things in your book. Well, in many books or in many lives, including mine and yours, there's these pivotal moments where, for example, if Jefferson did decide, you know what, I've done enough for my country, I can do something for it here, I'm just not going back, and then everything would have changed, wouldn't it?
Well, our history certainly would have been different, but Jefferson was a politician, you know. We think of him as something loftier than that, but all these men were political men, Madison, Jefferson, Washington also, though Washington is a bit different. He kind of stands off and stands above in some ways. It was his character, it was his personality. But Jefferson was highly political, and a little later in the decade of the 1790s, he begins undermining President George Washington. He's serving in the cabinet, but begins to undercut Washington because Washington is too Federalist for him. Jefferson even buys a newspaper so that he can have mud slung against the national government. I mean, he's not doing this openly, but he does buy the newspaper.
It's funny because in watching your YouTube kind of trailer for the book, you say exactly what you just said in different words. You say, these were not demigods. They were not gods. And someone today on the way to the interview, someone asked me, why don't you ask him whether they were part of the Illuminati? He was laughing when he said it. And what you're trying to say is, what you have said is, you know, these were just kind of regular guys. You just say they're politicians, but they kind of were just regular guys. And it's fascinating for us now to think back to that moment and look at it that way.
Yeah, that's very much so. That's very much so. They were for the most part ordinary men who achieved extraordinary things, and by virtue of their achievements, they became extraordinary. They made this crazy machine of government, as Patrick Henry called it, work. against the odds, really, if you think about it, against the odds.
Yeah.
And there were some towering figures. I mean, Madison, he didn't literally tower. He was a very short guy. He was about 5'1", sickly and hollow-chested, with a very whispery voice. But he was a towering intellect who was a brilliant politician. I mean, others whose names are much less familiar today, Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, an anti-federalist, but very, very active in criticizing the constitutional system, and Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut, who wrote the great judiciary law which set up our entire federal judiciary system, and others, Roger Sherman, also of Connecticut, who was pivotal in shaping the amendments that would become what we call the Bill of Rights. But, you know, they were all men with flaws and deficits and so on. And just to take one example, we've been talking about Madison a fair bit. Here was Madison who, for example, was an adamant opponent of amending the Constitution.
Right.
He was dead against it until he ran for Congress in an anti-federalist district in Virginia, when suddenly you hear him saying, well, actually, I've been for amendments all along. And then, after that, once he's elected, he starts saying, well, maybe not so much. So, in today's terms, he would be tarred by many as a classic flip-flopper. He was against amendments before he was for them, before he was against them again.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, you know, I don't want to dwell on it, but we're in times today where exactly that thing happens as a matter of course, almost expected by the public, the concept of flip-flopping. And, you know, I could ask you the cliche-ish question, you know, what would they have thought of us and what's happening, you know, in this election cycle? But one of the things you talk about in your book is they were pretty nasty to each other, and maybe as nasty or nastier than we are now.
Some were. They were very blunt-spoken. One example, one of my favorites, comes from William McClay, forgotten by most people, but he was one of Pennsylvania's two senators in that first Congress, and he's best known for having been the only member of the Senate who kept a diary. And that diary's in print. It's well worth reading if you have some background on the first Congress, because he was very outspoken in his diary, caustic, sarcastic. He didn't much like anybody. He went into Congress into the Senate as a strong Federalist, and he came out pretty close to an anti-Federalist because he was so disappointed both with the character and the politicking of his fellow senators, and the imperfections of the government that he lost a lot of confidence in it. But here's McClay in his diary who refers to, John Adams, the vice president, as a monkey in breeches. And at another time, he describes Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut, major figure in the Senate, as a man who managed to theatrically weep every time a vote didn't go his way, which had a magical effect on his fellow senator.
It's funny that.
And,
go ahead.
And there was much, much criticism of Madison's personality and his deviousness. In fact, one member of Congress refers to Madison's work on the amendments to become the Bill of Rights and said he made Machiavelli piddling by comparison.
Well, I guess it's not any worse than Trump calling Mr. Rubio Little Marco, especially
well,
if you look at Madison.
I don't think they would have been so shocked at things that are said today.
That's so funny. We haven't talked about, you know, money is the lubricant that allows these social organizations, which is now the term, work. And Alexander Hamilton really, to a great extent, helped make the country work because he understood money and the economy of the country.
Hamilton looms increasingly large in the course of the first Congress. Now he's the Secretary of the Treasury. He's not in Congress, but the United States in 1789 was plunged deep in debt. It did not pay its bills. It was a deadbeat nation, frankly. It was sort of like the Greece of the 1780s. There were many tens of millions of dollars of debt hanging over the country dating from the Revolutionary War, both a debt held against the national government and by many of the states, several of which had paid virtually nothing on their debts. Hamilton brilliantly came up with a plan for consolidating all this debt, having the federal government take it on as a national responsibility, and then with great discipline paying it off. Why not just write it off? Well, he knew the nation would need in future to borrow in order to survive. There would be times, wartime, he frequently cited as an example, critical moments when the government would need to borrow money. And if it was a deadbeat creditor, it wouldn't be able to, and it wouldn't be able to survive. And he made the case for a financial foundation for the United States based on the principles of capitalism, using debt as leverage, for example, having studied the way that worked in England, which was his model. And he worked desperately to persuade members of Congress to enact this financial plan for assuming all this debt and paying it off. And he met very, very strong headwinds among members of Congress in a country where hardly anybody had any kind of education in finance or economics. You can read letters written by members and others at the time saying, "What is Mr. Hamilton talking about? What is this science he calls finance?" It was that new to Americans then.
It's funny because I live in an area that's somewhat rural, and I won't mention the township in which I heard this, but the township attorney was speaking about the township needed to float a bond to, you know, fund either a school or a sewer plant or something like that. And one of the township supervisors actually said, "What's a bond?" And I was amazed. But then again, these guys were three farmers who had just decided they wanted to be supervisors. It's kind of like what you're talking about, and didn't understand it.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. Give the man credit for at least asking, and not being too embarrassed to ask. My guess is that he was enlightened and he proceeded in a capable way. I'm guessing
that would be a guess.
but that's very similar to the dilemma that Hamilton faced in that first Congress. Except these were the folks representing the national government.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how he pushed it through, because you explain it to a certain extent, but it's almost like, it's so much inertia that you have to push in one specific direction. And, you know, that's why there's all these books about Hamilton now, because I think it's fascinating that he had the strength, if that's what you would call it. I really don't understand. Well, explain it to me, why you think he had the ability to make this argument and make the argument work.
Sure. It's a great story, and it is a story, and has a dramatic arc to it.
Yeah.
Well, in point of fact, he didn't really succeed in persuading enough members to vote for his financial plan initially, even though he worked heroically to do so. He had support from men who were called high Federalists, largely in New England, New York, Pennsylvania, where they're members who had a business background and so on, or were attentive to business, but a great deal of opposition elsewhere, including from Pennsylvania Senator McClay, whom I referred to earlier. That was one of the, this financial plan was one of the things that disenchanted McClay from the Federalists. So what happened? Okay, there are two different extremely knotty issues being wrestled with at the same time. One of them is whether or not to adopt Hamilton's financial plan. The other is where to put the national capital. Now, that sounds like a kind of prosaic subject today, but it was bitterly fought at the time. Many states were competing for the capital. There were 32 different proposed locations, ranging from New York on the Hudson River all the way down to Norfolk, Virginia. Congress voted twice to put the national capital on the Susquehanna, near either Harrisburg or Columbia, Pennsylvania. Would have been an excellent site for the capital, in my opinion, by the way. The capital would certainly never have been captured and burned by the British in 1814. But in any case, those votes were undone by James Madison through a parliamentary ploy that is marvelous in its subtlety, but did not serve Pennsylvania well, because Pennsylvania lost the capital. So Madison, President Washington, and Southerners were lobbying each other vigorously. Washington stayed silent, but Washington wanted a Southern capital. Madison and other Southerners wanted a capital securely in the slave states, not in the increasingly free state of Pennsylvania with its Quakers, who were already calling upon Congress to legislate against slavery. They were frightened of a free state capital that would set freedom as the national standard rather than slavery in a capital placed in the slave states. So these two things are taking place at the same time. Neither problem seems to have a solution. So what happens? The first great backroom deal in American history takes place over Thomas Jefferson's dinner table in his home, his rented home on Maiden Lane, New York. You have sitting at his dinner table, of course, Jefferson himself presiding, Madison on one side and Hamilton on the other. They horse trade. Hamilton, an anti-slavery man, agrees not very happily to trade a number of northern votes for a southern capital, the one we have on the Potomac now, in return for Madison handing over a number of Potomac Valley votes, also very, very unhappily, in support of Hamilton's financial plan. So we got Hamilton's brilliant plan, establishing a capitalist foundation for the American Treasury on one hand, and we got a slave state capital on the other.
And didn't Washington have a financial interest in having the capital in Washington as well?
Yes, he did. Washington was, of course, famous for his personal probity and uprightness. But yes, he was given by Congress the authority to select the spot where the capital would be. Now, those advocating for a southern capital won it partly by intimating that the capital was likely to be way up at the Potomac River, maybe around Hancock, Maryland, which is where Maryland is narrowest, and that capital city might someday spread over three states, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Well, Washington, not so coincidentally, decided instead to put it right opposite his own home at Mount Vernon. And John Adams later wrote that, in his opinion, it increased the value of Mr. Washington's real estate by 1,000%.
Poor John Adams. And then he had to go down there in this muddy, marshy, yellow fever kind of area to live.
Well, you know, I think northern propagandists were very, very hard on the climate on the Potomac.
Okay.
It wasn't nearly as awful as they suggested. In fact, it was never a swamp. That was the accusation. It was never a swamp, actually. There were indeed what are called, or then called, water meadows, but no swamps. And yellow fever was much more devastating
in Philadelphia.
Than happened in, exactly, in Philadelphia in 1793. Monstrous epidemic. I've written about it in an earlier book, actually. Much worse than it was on the Potomac. In fact, it was that yellow fever epidemic that really kind of put paid to Philadelphia's hope of the capital staying there permanently.
Yeah, many times I walked down at Front Street and Market Street, and you can almost imagine what it must have been like at that time. It's you really are part of the history then, where you're going down Elfris Alley in the exact area where your book took place.
Yes, it is. Well, Philadelphia has preserved its history of that era far better than New York. New York has built over Lower Manhattan many, many times, and it's impossible in New York to get any feeling for what the place was like in the era of the First Congress. But Philadelphia has preserved, as you well know, many buildings, as well as, of course, the street plan and so on. And it's a lot tidier, a lot better scrubbed than it was in 1791, but at least it's there, and it feeds the imagination better, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing. You can go get a cup of coffee, and you're walking down the street, and there's Benjamin Franklin's grave with kids throwing pennies on top of it. You know, it's a very odd feeling.
And of course, when you visit the place, the building where Congress met in Philadelphia, you're immediately struck, I think anybody would be struck, by how small it is.
I know.
It's a fine building. But the rooms are tiny because Congress was tiny.
Yeah, but it almost seems as if it must have been overflowing at one time or another, and especially in the summer, it must have been oppressive, it seems to me.
No question about it, and indeed, members in their private letters complain about the heat. More in New York than in Philadelphia, I have to say.
Really?
More in New York. And one of the problems in New York, particularly, was the following. So the House of Representatives met on the ground floor and the Senate on the floor above it, also in Philadelphia. That's why we called the Senate the upper chamber, not because it was more important, but because it was upstairs. Senators have of course treated the term as meaning something more lofty than it was intended in the beginning. But so the loudest member of Congress was a man named James Jackson from Georgia, who was he was a militia colonel, as a matter of fact, and a loud, brash, overbearing man, especially on the subject of slavery. And when he rose to speak on a subject, he shouted at the top of his lungs, and the senators upstairs repeatedly had to shut their windows in the heat of the summer. And you can hear them say, "Oh, there's Jackson again. Close the windows." And they frequently remark on how oppressive the heat was under those circumstances.
How did it I know you talk in your book about the amendments being winnowed down. Talk to us about how many there were and how varied they were and how it ended up being simply the dozen that we have as, you know.
Yeah, it was very interesting. We, of course, today regard, rightly, the amendments as, particularly what we call the Bill of Rights, they didn't call it the Bill of Rights, as a majestic component of our constitutional system. I was really surprised, even astonished, at the fact that members of Congress in that first Congress really didn't take the amendments very seriously. There was an enormous opposition to any amendments whatsoever, not because they considered the Constitution a sacred document, because they didn't. They were very pragmatic about the Constitution, but because they regarded it as too new, too frail, to be tampered with right away. Nonetheless, anti-federalists, those were the Americans who disliked the Constitution, they disliked stronger central government, they wanted to go back to a more states' rights orientation, as had existed under the Articles of Confederation. conventions. These are kind of ad hoc conventions in all the states, submitted something over 200 different proposed amendments. Many of them, a great many of them, designed to undermine the strong central government. So Congress wisely handed over to James Madison personally the power to, or the job, let's say, the job of consolidating some of these amendments in a form that could actually be considered by Congress. Many of them were overlapping and used similar, if not identical, language. Anyway, so Madison took these 200 plus and he winnowed them down to 19, then committees, whittled them further down to 17, and then finally to 12. And 12 were approved by Congress. Only 10 of them were actually ratified by the states. So we have what we call a Bill of Rights that consisted of 10 amendments instead of 12. And, you know, many Americans today on different places on the political spectrum will say very authoritatively, well, the First Amendment is the most important because, you know, they put it first for a reason. Well, the truth is they didn't, actually. The first was not first. The first was the third, and the second, as we know today, was the fourth. And the language of these amendments shifted constantly, and the numbering shifted constantly. It was a sausage. The passage of the amendments is a sausage-making machine. And one might ask, well, what were those other two amendments that weren't approved, weren't ratified by the states? The First Amendment, the original First Amendment, had to do with the size of congressional districts, and the second original amendment had to do with raising the salaries of members of Congress. And I mean, you can imagine why that second one perhaps wasn't ratified at the time. But so the debate was really not so much over the content of amendments, but over whether there should be any amendments. By and large, Federalists who wanted the strongest possible federal government opposed amendments. They said the Constitution's too new and too fragile. As I said, anti-Federalists tend to demand amendments. What Madison did in his winnowing process was not only cut the number down, but he also turned even those that became amendments into what his enemies called just the most milk and water amendments possible, critics compared them to meringue, which was sweet to the taste but had no content.
Well, it's funny though, if you look at things now, whether you want to look at the Constitution as a living, breathing document or as a static document. Whether you're a strict constructionist, and look what's happening with the Supreme Court now. But if you deconstruct, say, the Second Amendment, and eliminated the first clause, I mean, I had correspondence at one time with the NRA president about, in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, and what that really meant. So that amendment is anti-federalist in the sense that the states could, I'm just positing this, I don't know what the answer is, the states could, if they needed to, overthrow the federal government by maintaining this well-regulated militia? Did anybody, and if you're saying it's froth and meringue, someone gave a great deal of thought to that froth and meringue before that amendment became law.
Well, Sam, I have to tell you, and this is surprising, not much thought was given to it. It's
really
astonishing how little thought was given to it. There was almost no discussion of that amendment.
Really?
Almost none. Did not regard it as an important one. In fact, they didn't regard the first one, our present-day First Amendment, as an important one either. And this challenges our belief in,
yes,
in what the founders considered important.
Huh.
let's stick with the Second Amendment since you brought it up.
Okay.
There's a debate over the Second Amendment today solely because there's an incredibly powerful lobbying organization in this country which has an enormous interest, and an industry which has an enormous interest in sowing the notion that that the founders wanted guns in the hands of everybody. It's just it never came up in those terms. Never. It's not discussed in those terms. And it's also clear from the discussion that did take place what they were thinking of. Now, they did leave a little crack in the door for debate, and that's where we are today. The NRA has its foot in that crack. But it's manifestly clear that what members of Congress were talking about was official militias. There was no standing army. What that really had to do, the amendment had to do with, was this, that opposition to a standing army was intense, because when Americans in 1789 thought of a standing army, they thought of the British army being quartered in your house, eating at your table, and messing with your women folk. That's what they were thinking of.
Right.
You know, an oppressive foreign army. So who is going to defend the country? Militias that were raised by the states. And Secretary of War Henry Knox laid out an immensely detailed plan for how those militias would be used and organized according to a national, centrally organized plan. That's what he had in mind. Not a bunch of six guys who hate the federal government grabbing machine guns and you know, laying siege to government facilities. Know what they're talking about. The NRA may think differently because it's in their interest.
And that's what's so interesting about all of this, is that the story that you paint, and if that story is true, then much of what we do now in interpreting, for example, that was a perfectly good question, because the interpretation of that amendment isn't based on some sturdy fact or foundation. The two arguments, whether it's abortion or gun control or the death penalty or whatever it is, there's two sides to each. And those sides generally don't listen to one another. But they're basing their arguments on this document that over a couple of months was hammered out by two or three 35-year-olds and a couple of 57-year-old people. And it just kind of, it's not disillusioning, but it's not what I was obviously taught. Not what I grew up to understand. So your book it wakes you up, is what it does.
Well, I hope so. And I should underscore here: this book isn't a polemic. It's not serving a present day agenda. I'm interested in looking at what they did in 1789 and 1791, and how amazingly enough these men created a government. And they were often, they were human beings, and they were working with often flawed instruments, and the Constitution was an imperfect instrument. That's why there are amendments and why there were provisions for amendments. And, frankly, many of the amendments and some of the wording of the Constitution is kind of fuzzy. It's not written all that well. A lot of it was compromise language, that lent itself to being interpreted differently, later on. And, now, originalism is a modern idea that projects backward onto the men of the past what certain present day Americans want. The originators of the Constitution were not themselves originalists.
But the problem I see that you have is that the template upon which the reader's experience must necessarily be laid upon your words, and you can't help that. And so if I was taught in elementary school that this is what they meant, I have to be disproved in my own mind. It's not cataclysmic, but it is, you know, like scales from my eyes. For example, in using your own words, in its three sessions of Congress now accomplished less than absolutely nothing. So in its three sessions, the first two in New York and the third in Philadelphia, it would create the Departments of State, War, and Treasury, the Supreme Court, the federal court system, and the first federal criminal code. That they're not even going to begin to hear whether or not Obama wants a Supreme Court justice for the next year. So in three sessions, what is done is more than has been done since then, it appears to me. And you're kind of saying some of it was just, you know, okay, let's do this. Well, you throw this in, I'll throw that in. Granted, that's what happens now, too, but this is so much more important to me.
Yes. Let me put it a slightly different way then. I mean, I don't mean to imply that they were habitually casual about what they were doing. They weren't. It was a lot of work to take 200 proposed amendments and turn them into 10 or a dozen. And what Madison was doing was essentially defanging amendments that he felt would weaken the executive and weaken the strength of the federal government, because that was an imperative for him, that the government would be strong, that the presidency, which is being invented just as Congress is inventing itself in this first federal Congress, that they have power to act. What are they doing? They're doing politics. You know, these folks fought the Revolutionary War to put politics in government, not to take politics out of government. And I think there's a notion abroad in the United States today that somehow if we could strip politics out of government, we'd all be better off and government would work better. Well, you know, frankly, that's called dictatorship.
Yes.
Our forebears wanted to do politics. They fought a revolution to be free to do politics. And the Constitution recognized, as Madison and his colleagues did, that there was going to be conflict. There was going to be argument. There were going to be differing interpretations. They took it as a given. But they were also very, very pragmatic. And did not let ideological attitudes or zealotry get in the way of making this machine work, of building the machine and then making it work. And we're in an era today when, for the first time in American history, we have a substantial portion of the population, and one might argue one of the major policy, one of the major political parties, that has been campaigning against government itself. We've never had that. I mean, even the secessionists of 1860 weren't campaigning against the form of government. They just wanted to keep slavery. And when they wrote the Confederate Constitution, they basically copied the U.S. Constitution with a few tweaks, for example, guaranteeing slavery in perpetuity. But they didn't attack the fundamental operations of government. And this is something new on our present-day landscape.
And I don't mean to take each of your paragraphs and somehow say that it's different than the way it was. Obviously, it isn't. But if you take, and I will, but now I'm going to do it anyway. In this one paragraph where you say, it would take months for the other parts of the government to take shape and bring their own political coloration to the dawn of the new system. During the first Congress, however, George Washington, so nervous that his hands shook at his inauguration, would gradually invent the presidency, stretch its powers, pry it away from the domination of Congress, and begin to define the parameters of the office for generations to come. It's almost like the cult of personality, like Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt forging by themselves, in large part, the nature and course of the war. So it's like you are saying that George Washington defined the presidency. So it is one man. That's what is mystical to me and magical to me and mythological to me, is that this one person, had it been a different person, the presidency would be different today. You agree?
Oh, absolutely true. There really was no other viable candidate for the office. Washington was the perfect man for it. Perfect. But I want to go back. You know why he's different from some of the other figures you mentioned? First, the context. there had been no presidency under the Articles of Confederation or the Continental Congress. Congress had a presiding officer, but he was essentially an administrator. There was no president. There was no executive as such. So this is a new office that has no content, actually. It's an empty bowl. And Federalists, Madison leading among them, want to put power into that empty bowl. So it's not as if Washington is taking office with a ready-made power structure. His hands are shaking because he doesn't know what it is. And he doesn't know whether he's up to the task either.
Why don't you...
I want to just add one other thing there. What's really crucial to Washington is that, unlike the other individuals you mentioned, Washington is a Republican in his bones. That's obviously a small R Republican. In his bones. He believes in representative government. He believes that Congress is the leading branch, not the presidency. That it's his job as president to execute the legislation of Congress, but not to lead Congress. In this, he differs from 20th century presidents who, we all, since the 1930s, have looked to the president to lead Congress, to come in with an agenda, a plan for the first 100 days or something. Washington didn't have any of that.
Just for fun, talk about some of the names that were proposed for the leader of the country.
Yeah. Oh, they were some very, very extravagant titles were suggested, generally by high Federalists, most tenaciously by John Adams, who definitely had a what was called at the time, fairly, I think, a monarchist streak. He had lived too long in England as an ambassador. The least of these titles were such as His Excellency, and they went on from there and were more and more ornate. Washington, to his credit, flatly rejected such titles. He absolutely refused. Adams is rather famous at the time for disparaging the title president. He said it was just sit for the captain of a cricket team. but Washington had a finer sense of what Americans wanted, and for the incipient democratization of America, it's only beginning. It's not a democracy. It's a republic. And many, many people are not able to vote because of property restrictions in 1789. That'll open up in years to come. But now Washington really, really kind of had his ear to the ground. It's kind of hard to imagine George Washington down on his knees with his ear to the ground, aren't you? But he sensed that what Americans wanted much better than Adams and some of the high Federalists did.
Maybe it's my affinity for magical realism, but you say he had his ear to the ground. But look at what we have today. We have CNN all day today, all day tomorrow, talking about the election and every aspect of it. And everybody instantaneously through Twitter, which is ridiculous, or through email or texting or whatever, knows everything immediately. So how can you have your ear to the ground when your country is dispersed and the only means of communication is by someone traveling with a horse to another place with a piece of paper in his hand?
Well, we were a much smaller country, bear in mind. And we are vast today, and we're 300 plus million. And in today's America, we have people believe everything that's imaginable to the human mind. It's believed by somebody or a faction in the United States. The size and diversity of this country are certainly daunting to anybody, as any politician aspiring to national office. And the America of 1789 was pretty small, was really pretty small, and everybody was approachable. New York was only the second largest. Philadelphia, where you are, is the largest city in the country with a population of just 40,000 people. New York is second with 30,000. Boston has only 15,000 people, approximately. Washington, even as president, goes on two journeys to talk to Americans. He visits factories, he visits farmers, he visits fisheries, talking to regular people. And he's been George Washington is pretty close to the most traveled American of his time because of all the traveling he had done during the Revolutionary War. And he had been, as commander of the army, he was a very lofty individual. But on the other hand, he had been spent years among ordinary soldiers from all kinds of backgrounds, New England, South, Mid-Atlantic states. So he actually, I think, had a finer grasp of what Americans were thinking than many of his contemporaries who hadn't traveled as much.
It sounds as if, and it does resonate in your book, too, it sounds as if there's a hero to this, that Washington, both in physical stature and in character, is kind of the hero of this book in a number of ways.
He is, to the extent that he was a totally successful president. He shaped the presidency in a way that stood the test of time. He had unshakable respect for Republican institutions. He had no desire to assert personal power at all on that score. And he also benefited, of course, from personal charisma that
right.
came from his years as commander-in-chief. But I do have to say that Madison, who's not, it's hard to get close to Madison. It's hard to get close to Washington, too. But, I mean, Madison is almost totally cerebral. And it's very hard to imagine just sitting down and having a cup of coffee or a beer with John Madison or I guess Washington either. But people did go and dine at the president's house in company. It was a pretty austere experience, but there are no letters talking about dining in Madison's house, you know?
No, well, and again, with me having my eye in the present and you perforce having your eye in the past, I'm thinking, okay, what would we do today with a 5'1", hollow-chested politician who was out campaigning or trying to get his agenda across? It's the image today, because it would be plastered everywhere, it would be impossible, although completely unfair, for that to happen. And it's a very strange thing to think.
That's absolutely true. And not only that, he was also a, if there were such a thing, a card-carrying intellectual of the first order.
An egghead.
You know? And people who are openly intellectual in our political environment, I would say our president, Barack Obama, somewhat fits that category, generally don't do very well.
No.
And Al Gore is another example, I think, in recent years. But they're not the only ones. They don't fare well. Of course, true, in 1789, most people had no idea what political men looked like unless they were from the neighborhood.
Right.
George Washington might have been the only American whose face was recognizable to everybody. Probably the only one. Because his face was replicated on, not only in lithographs and so on, but on mugs and shaving mugs, drinking mugs, flatware, wall hangings of a sort, and so on. Everybody knew what Washington looked like, but so nobody knew, other than Madison's, the people who elected Madison, that he was a 5'1", hollow-chested guy in bad health, who was chronically constipated, you know?
It's so funny. I'm just looking at the book now, and I realize, and we've been talking for almost an hour, and we talked early on about how long the interview would last, but I realize I could go through each paragraph and discuss them vigorously with you because it's such a fascinating book. So I wanted to thank you so much for being here today and for answering what sometimes might have seemed like, I don't know, my questions, like I said, are born of my experience here in the present, and perhaps I should have left those by the wayside when I read your book. But But I wanted to thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Sam. It's been a great pleasure.
That was Fergus Borgwick. The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. We weren't at loggerheads, but you can understand my feeling that the present is the present, the past is the past, and I want the Constitution to be this mythological document handed down by God to Moses and then brought down to his people. And what's so cool about this book is it wasn't that at all. The amendments weren't meant to be, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of press, the ability to redress grievances. There was no intention of allowing everyone to have handguns. None of that. It was all working things out. And the way they worked out is now the way things are. And the way Washington shaped his presidency is now the way the presidency is. And it's just interesting. It's like the butterfly effect. You know, a butterfly flaps its wings somewhere in Central Africa, and eventually we end up with Hurricane Katrina. And that's the way countries go. That's the way nations go. That's the way empires go. And that's why they fall in similar fashion. So in any event, thanks as always. Join us every week. We got Karen Mahajan, who will discuss his highly anticipated new novel, The Association of Small Bombs, which is a good book. Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award finalist Adam Hazlett, who will discuss his new novel, which is amazing, Imagine Me Gone. I think it could win the Pulitzer Prize. And Colin Wink, who will join us to talk about his amazing collection. You know, I say amazing, that they actually are amazing. A collection of short stories, Dog, Run, Moon. So for a complete schedule, please visit us at WellingtonSquareBooks.com, WCHE1520.com, or you can just go to our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic, Twitter, what else, Instagram, whatever else you want to go to. So thanks as always for joining us here on The Avid Reader.